This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com.
All right, the guys, the team, they have been talking about the big bank earnings. We got a bunch last week. We got some this morning, some key ones, kind of getting ready to really wrap up this sector and start to look forward at other earnings. But we've got to talk a little bit more about Goldman Sachs having their worst day in terms of the stock price since 2020. This is after the bank reported worse than expected net revenue for the fourth quarter, its compensation ratio hitting a decade Hi, Tim.
Well, let's see how Allison Williams, a senior global bank analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, characterizes the quarter. She's here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Allison, good to have you with us. I know you've been up since the early hours following these
results.
Can
you say what Evercore ISI called
it? Oh, yeah. I did have this in the intro. Evercore ISI analyst Glenn Shore called the results a, quote, uncharacteristic dud.
Do you agree, Allison?
I mean, I think there are some positive in the results. I think the main negative is costs. And Solomon had sort of signaled this. You know, obviously, as the markets have been tougher this year, analysts have been expecting, including myself, some of the competitive compensation pressures to ease a bit. And that just has not happened as much as we would have thought. I think part of that is the boutiques are hiring. I think that Wall Street has been slow to throw in the towel on investment banking fees, even though we've had it was like the worst equities year since in 20 years.
It was a bummer.
It was a tough year. That was an uncharacteristic dud. But it does, yeah. And so when I look at the revenue line, they're trading. We look at their trading just to see how their market share is going. That they still earn more from trading than anyone else. That's a core business. They've stuck to that franchise even when others have pulled back. They're continuing to gain share. And their advisory revenue, as we said, fees are down. Like, you know, they're about half. But within fees, Goldman is the advisory fee leader. And revenue there was much more resilient than we thought. So those are the two positives. That they are overwhelmed by the cost side of things and the returns. Single-digit returns is not something that investors want to see.
Allison, one of the things I always wonder, too, is, you know, we had Morgan Stanley, right, that seemed to do really well today. I think of J.P. Morgan, B of A, Wells, like last week. They're not all apples to apples. We know that.
Exactly.
So I guess, how do you look at Goldman and say, yeah, they're just fine? Or like, how do you characterize it?
So I would say,
against kind of the bigger, broader backdrop.
So if we look across the core themes, in general, fees were very weak. Goldman did better on that. And Goldman did better on the trading side of things. So those are their core businesses. Mm-hmm. So fixed strong, equities weak, fees weak are the themes of the quarter. Relative to that, I would say Goldman did a little bit better. JP Morgan did worse. Morgan Stanley mixed. As I said, the costs were really the big negative for Goldman. That's really the negative. We're going to want to hear more about that Investor Day. Morgan Stanley, it was really about their wealth business, the net interest income, which was really disappointing last week, holding up better than expected. And of course, we know it's all about how do they do versus expectations. And so I think a lot of that is the setup also relates to how the stocks are reacting.
How are costs still such an issue right now, Allison? Because I thought we were at a point where, you know, these companies are, you know, they're saying, okay, well, Goldman, for example, 3,200 people.
Right,
3,200 people getting laid off. And then, you know, you have other companies out there doing layoffs as well. So it's not exactly, you know, end of 2020, early 2021 in terms of the fight for talent.
So it's not, but we also did see, you know, we saw the competitive cost pressures also at JP Morgan. Also at Morgan Stanley, we're seeing it, just not as acute. And I think it is because, as I said, so we heard a lot about the Goldman job cuts. That did not happen until this year. So that's mm-hmm. a 2023 event. Okay. They did say, you know, it's something like, you know, I want to say 400 or 500 million of severance expenses. I don't recall the exact number offhand, but adding to some cost saves, and all of that will come into effect this year. They're having an investor day at the end of February. I think we'll hear a lot more on that. And then it's just that even though there are some pressures easing, right, the hiring pressure from fintech is not as acute. Obviously, their cost of capital has gone up a lot. Things are tougher there.
Right. It's like almost every other day we're hearing about fintech layoffs.
Right. But macro hedge funds did very well last year, so there's still competition from those firms. And then, as I said, if you look at the boutique hiring firms, and there's a lot more of those companies that are public now, the pressure is still on.
And it's not like, you know, crypto firms are coming out and stealing workers like they were a couple of years ago.
But I do think about, you got an MBA at Columbia. Like, I think about, do people still get an MBA and say, I want to go to Goldman, I want to go to JP Morgan? Or they say, maybe, maybe not. Like, is it different so that they do have to compete that much more?
I think they do, but I would say that, you know, perhaps versus a couple of years ago, we talked about, you know, you talked about crypto. Maybe the job opportunities in tech might not seem so lucrative. Stock options are a little less attractive coming off a year like last year. And certainly the past doesn't guarantee the future, but
good point.
But I think that does, you know, the most recent performance does tend to stick into people's heads. Goldman and JP Morgan will always give statistics about how competitive it is to work for their firms, and certainly across Wall Street.
It's like getting into an Ivy League school.
Those are
look at the numbers. Look at the
I think it might be Goldman, or it's one of the firms that has given that stat that they're harder to get into than some of the Ivy Leagues.
So we've heard from four banks last week, two big banks today. How would you characterize, in a few sentences, the commonalities between how these companies are seeing 2023 and the environment?
Costs are going to continue to be a pressure and something that has to be managed. And not just compensation. So we talked a lot about in the last few minutes compensation, but there's also inflation.
Yeah.
And there's also technology spending. You know, banks have to invest to compete. But then there is this question of business mix. So net interest income, even though there was some disappointment in the guidance, some people were disappointed, still growth there, still expecting very good growth in net interest income after amazing growth that we saw.
I mean, they're
this
doing
year.
Okay.
So yeah, so there's a
sorry,
good
no
top
my
line.
Sarcasm.
Like there's a pretty big top line to fund that bottom line, but I think the difference is who has, you know, the companies that are more Main Street versus Wall Street, right? So Main Street,
right.
Interest income, there's a lot more to fund those costs. It makes your overall profitability look better. JP Morgan had huge cost increases last year, huge investments, and still managed to meet their over the cycle return on equity, tangible equity target.
Yeah.
Whereas Goldman Sachs, which is much more focused on the markets, you know, they kept saying on their call several times today, it's the first time in 50 years that we saw equity and bonds both get hit like this. You know, Morgan Stanley CEO also talking about like how many years has it been since we saw this inflation, since we saw a war.
Right.
So tough time for capital markets, tougher time for the two that reported today.
So smart. Allison Williams, Senior Global Banks Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, right here in studio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the 41-year-old Winklevoss twins.
I believe it's pronounced Winklevi.
Also known as Cameron and Tyler. They went head-to-head with Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, and they're now part of the crypto collapse conversation. Now they're going after a lot of others. I feel like this story just is a reminder, Tim, of kind of all the crypto kids out there saying, I didn't do it, I didn't do it.
Well, that's exactly what Max Chafkin, a Bloomberg Business Week columnist, writes about it. He notes that the Winklevi are the latest crypto founders to dodge blame. Let's get into the story. We got Max on Zoom, along with the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber. Joel's with us in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Joel, it's all good in crypto when the price keeps going up.
All good. All good. And then it gets just more entertaining, I guess. And look, the Winklevi, plural. boy, they just, I love them so much. Like, it never gets old. And obviously, yeah, we know them for their Facebook days, but the crypto stuff, they went all in on crypto.
I thought
they
you were talking about their band.
Well, there's the band too, okay. Right? And but they, you know what Max writes
Max,
about here.
Don't fall off your chair there, laughing.
is that, you know, they're in the spotlight now. They've got SEC breathing down them, and they have chosen to go scorched earth on everyone.
Yeah, and we're seeing this a lot from the world of crypto. Basically, you know. Starting with Sam Bankman-Fried, who, of course, dropped a new Substack last week, kind of going down the line. And the Winklevi bosses, it is kind of one of the richer ones, just because they spent, you know, basically the last few years when they weren't rocking out in their band, which is
Don't stop
a whole other topic we should explore. They were talking about just how sober-minded they were. You know, they had these ads that you know, were all over New York that said the revolution needs rules. They were talking about how they were the only regulated crypto exchange, which was true, although they weren't regulated in every aspect. And this product, Gemini Earn, which, you know, Business Week wrote about this and similar things 2 years ago as a potential area of, you know, exposure, regulatory risk, and so on. And, you know, the SEC has been investigating, and of course they finally moved. Cameron and Tyler, the two Winklevoss brothers, are acting as if this was sprung on them. This was some kind of you know, political act by the SEC, which I'm sure on some level it's political. You know, we're talking about the government here, but this is something that was a long time coming. This is not a surprise. The SEC had gone after very similar groups, including one that the Winklevoss, you know, had invested in. So I don't think we should be surprised by this at all.
Okay, so Gemini Earn actually is the root of where the current ire is directed, right? So what's going on there? What did the government say they were doing?
Well, the government has gone after Gemini, which is the Winklevoss brothers, and Genesis, which is Barry Silbert's digital currency group, is the parent. They together, according to the government, were basically offering unregistered securities. What they were doing is offering this product that kind of looked like a bank account. They would sort of talk about it as interest rate and talk about it as a competitor to like your savings account. Of course, the interest rates were much higher. It was not a bank. And as the SEC is saying, you know, it was not a security either. And so that's where we are now.
So I guess the question is, what happens since all these folks are kind of like, you know, I don't even want to call them frenemies anymore. They're really going after one another. And these are people who were, you know, in the world of, in the context of crypto, you know, quote unquote, longtime partners. Max, how do you see this kind of thing shaking out? And is this kind of when in the early life cycle of new technologies, because you've written about this a lot in your books and other things, is this kind of how things work?
Well, I do think there are parallels here in terms of the approach that these crypto guys followed to Silicon Valley. You know, when think back to Uber, right, where Uber basically rolled out this service that was largely illegal in most localities and essentially dared regulators to make it legal. And I think the crypto guys, including the Winklevoss brothers, basically did the same thing. And they have been for years kind of maneuvering and trying to create, basically trying to romance DC while also maybe putting pressure on DC, playing regulators off, you know, off one another. We saw a lot of this from Sam Bankman-Fried. And now that the music has stopped, now that we've seen some serious issues, we have a real slowdown, we have investor pain that, you know, people lost money that who probably didn't deserve it. That story is getting harder. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of why they're getting more aggressive. Basically looking, you know, hopefully the government will focus on the other guy. That's the basic idea here.
You know what, Matt, I'm curious, Max rather, is there something generational you think going on in terms of kind of a younger bunch of folks in this industry and very involved in developing it? Is there something, like I said, generational that causes so many to say, I didn't do it, you did it, or just point the finger and it wasn't
me. Twitter's good for that, right?
Twitter.
I don't know if it's generational or if it's just a response to like this looks bad. I mean, you know, okay. You've got, I don't really know, the Winklevoss brothers kind of framed their company as this super safe, super secure thing. And now you have customers, hundreds of thousands of customers who can't access their money. And so I think maybe strategically, you know, this is their only option is to try to pin it on somebody else. I've talked about this, I think, on this show earlier. You know, maybe it's this SEC's fault. Maybe it's Sam Bankman-Fried's fault. It's got to be somebody's fault as long as it's not me. And I think really that's to deal with the brand damage that they've caused themselves. And this is, of course, some of this stuff the Winklevoss brothers could not control. However, when you promote something as safe, and which I think they did, and you and your customers lose your money, I mean, I think it's reasonable to ask, you know, what happened.
Okay, what I really want to know, Max, is how much of their band's music you listen to report on this story.
You know, I did not suffer that much, I'll say, but although I have listened to some tunes, I guess this was part of a, you know, NFT promotion scheme. I tried to figure out, like, were they paying the audiences? Because the music sounds so bad that it's hard to imagine somebody, like, going to,
Max.
You know, going to the show on purpose.
He is a journalist.
But they're billionaires, and maybe it's possible, I guess, that the allure here was like, wow, we're going to see these, like, crypto moguls pretend to be rock stars. And it's hard to imagine that would draw huge crowds. But either way, I mean, it really feels unfortunate. It feels like at a time when they really should have been paying attention, you know, to things like risk and you know, what they were doing with their money, they were, you know, rocking out. And we all need to rock out sometimes, I guess. But again, it's not the best look at this.
No.
Okay. If I was going to rock out, which cover would you recommend that I check out first?
Just quickly, man.
The Journey one is the
Don't Stop Believing. I was hoping you would say that.
It's a little. It's a little.
I'll be back in 5 minutes.
A lot pitchy.
We'll put out the link. We're going to put out the link. All right. This, by the way, is today's Bloomberg Businessweek Daily newsletter. In the newsletter, it's also in the upcoming new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek. Thanks to Max and to Joel.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
One is raising money at an ever-rising valuation. The other has been pummeled by the market. One has a highly capable number two exec keeping it on track. The other under fire about succession planning. What are we talking about? SpaceX and Tesla, first of all, that's who we're talking about. And they both count Elon Musk as CEO.
Here's the thing, though. Whereas Tesla has withered since the boss embarked on his takeover of Twitter, SpaceX is flourishing. Some even suggest this is because of, rather than in spite of, its CEO playing a less active role. These are all the words of Lauren Grush. She's a Bloomberg News space reporter. She's got a new feature out today. It's a fantastic one, talking all about what's going on at SpaceX and the success that the company has had of late and even over the last few years. She joins us now via Zoom from Austin, Texas. Lauren, good to have you with us this afternoon. So why is SpaceX doing so well?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that, you know, SpaceX has really well-positioned executives. They have a very capable president and COO, Gwynne Shotwell, and they also have a lot of VPs that are already in place with these various big projects that they're working on. I make a note of Mark Giancosa, who recently took over Starship, which is SpaceX's big program to create a massive new vehicle to send humans to the moon and Mars. And it's not just Mark. There are other VPs that are, you know, in key positions that standardize the workflow and make sure the company is running when Elon isn't around.
You know, it's so, this is such an interesting story, because I do feel like, is this almost a B-school case study of like, okay, here's what Elon can do when he puts, you know, certain people in charge, because he has so much under, you know, his umbrella at this point. What is interesting about the executives who brought them in? Was it all Elon's doing?
Yeah, I mean, these are handpicked by Elon. And let's be clear here. I mean, this isn't to say that Elon doesn't have a profound influence on SpaceX and SpaceX culture. I mean, he is the one, as I said it in the article, he sets the long-term vision, the long-term goals. I mean, the express purpose of SpaceX is to get to Mars, right? That is still very much the long-term goal of the company. And when it comes to various design decisions, you know, Elon puts his stamp on those things as well. You know, the push to reuse rockets, you know, even and it also has a lasting impact on the design of certain vehicles, right? One former employee was telling me that, you know, there were plans to propulsively land the Crew Dragon. And while that was scrapped, those plans are still in the bones of that vehicle. So Elon still is very critical when it comes to guiding the company and also the people that he puts in charge. But when it comes to the day-to-day interactions, the design and, you know, schedule decisions, that's where, you know, he's not as necessary to move those things forward.
So how is, and I know this is a story about SpaceX more so than it is about Tesla or about Twitter, but how does that management style differ from what Musk shows at the other companies that he's at the helm of?
Well, I'm not as well versed in Tesla, but I have been following the Twitter stuff, and a lot of the employees that I spoke to say that, you know, watching the Twitter stuff play out online and in media feels very similar to some of the things that happen at SpaceX. It's a lot of chaos when it comes to meetings being scheduled and then canceled. Also, you know, just him inserting himself into things and making demands. You know, there was a lot of talk about how he likes to make design decisions that, you know, create all of this work, like something might have too many wires. He's always in service of simplifying design. Whether or not that is actually helpful to the design in the long term is up for debate. But, you know, he likes to come in and say, you know, let's get rid of this part. Let's get rid of this component. Let's get rid of these wires. And then that creates a lot of work for people. And then sometimes that stuff needs to be added back in at the end of the day. And that work will have all been kind of reversed in the long run.
So, Lauren, can we go as far as to say the folks at SpaceX are kind of happy that he's been distracted with Twitter right now?
Obviously, I didn't speak to every single employee at SpaceX, but of the people I spoke with, yes, there is a general sense of relief, and just that, you know, it's less unexpected meetings, less unexpected, you know, having to rework their designs. You know, it's more of a semblance of calm because, you know, he's not inserting himself into these workflows that have become standardized and you know, schedules that are more or less routine.
Hey, can you talk to us a little bit more about Gwynne Shotwell? She's the president and COO of SpaceX, and she's a name that comes up a lot when you read about the success of SpaceX.
Yeah, absolutely. I think from both internal and external perspectives, Gwynne is kind of seen as the one running the show, especially when Elon is not around. She's very much involved in the business side of things as the COO, and she's just kind of, you know, this pillar of strength for most of the SpaceX employees. But it's also important to remember that she does, you know, report to Elon. And so every now and then you'll see her having to execute Elon's vision. At the end of the day, she does report to him. So, you know, if he makes a demand, she's got to do it. And also, you know, you saw that with sometimes she can take on Elon's role a bit when, you know, negative things are happening with the company. We saw this last year when, you know, a bunch of employees had penned an open letter denouncing Elon's tactics and or antics online. And, you know, she took it upon herself to fire those employees. So sometimes she can take on a bit of an Elon role as well. But more or less, she's kind of the steady hand at the company.
I wonder too, Lauren, and you know, you've done so much reporting on SpaceX, but it's a private company, and we do see the valuation because, you know, the company has recently raised money, so we see what the market is valuing the company at. But we don't see, you know, quarterly earnings from the company. We don't see updates that are required as a result of being a publicly traded company like we do with Tesla, you know, before Elon Musk bought it, like we saw with Twitter. And I'm wondering if that has anything to do with the success of SpaceX.
You know, I would love to know more about the financials of SpaceX. I think everybody would. I know there's been talk about whether or not that valuation is warranted or if it's overhyped. I'll just say this. I mean,
you're talking about a $140 billion valuation, right?
Right, exactly. Okay. I'll say this. SpaceX has become a major, if not the most dominant player in the U.S. launch market right now. I mean, they are a valuable NASA partner. I mean, they are the Starship, the vehicle I mentioned, has a NASA contract to eventually land NASA astronauts on the moon this decade. And, you know, they are working, they have these crazy goals of launching up to 100 flights this year. Many of those will be Starlink launches to build out the company's Internet from Space initiative, which now boasts 1 million subscribers. And they, and as we wait for ULA to create its next, to transition to its new vehicle, the Vulcan, SpaceX is kind of the main launch provider at the moment, constantly racking up contracts with the Defense Department and NASA. So, I mean, there can be debate over whether the numbers are right for the valuation, but ultimately SpaceX is a critical U.S. company in the space industry right now.
Hey, listen, just one last question, Lauren. Like, I think of back in 2018, it was in the summer of 2018, Max Chafkin and Dana Hull put out a story. It was Business Week, the space issue. And SpaceX's secret weapon is Gwynne Shotwell. And I do think about, you know, her role and her success. She's now been there for several years. And, you know, does the investment community say, you know, as goes Gwynne, as goes, you know, SpaceX? Like, how important is she? As you say, Elon puts his stamp on it and he gets involved in the long vision. But also, how, you know, important is the future? You know, how much of it is Gwynne connected to that company? I'm just curious what you hear generally.
I mean, I think it's certainly a major part, you know, and you see this with his other companies, like with Tesla, for instance, doesn't really have a Gwynne equivalent. I mean,
right.
Obviously they have their own executives, but no one quite like Gwynne in the sense of, you know, how she runs things and handles things. So I think she's definitely a very big part of the successful equation, but it also has to do with, you know, the engineers and the workflows that they've established at the company. So there is that as well.
We think about STEM companies, right? This is really, truly a STEM company.
It doesn't get more STEM than launching rockets.
Yeah. Exactly. Great stuff. So glad we got some time with you. Lauren Grush, she's space reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us via Zoom from Austin, Texas, which we, of course, knows where Tesla is headquartered. Everything, right?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say everything.
Well, that's true.
No. I mean, it was the theme of, what was it, 2021 or 2022, Carol, where all these companies were moving from California.
But isn't
to Texas?
That like he shifted his headquarters?
Oh, yeah,
he sold all his real estate,
yeah.
Elon Musk, and said, you know.
Yeah, but, you know,
planting
as Dana Hull reminds us, there are significant operations for Tesla in California still.
That's
in
very
that Fremont,
true.
Fremont
that,
facility.
That is a really good point. Great story. Check it out. Just head to Bloomberg.com or check out Lauren at Lauren Grush on Twitter. Carol Masser, Tim Stenovic, Bloomberg Business Week, right here on Bloomberg Radio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new. to build something better. To know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, we've got 17 minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap up the first trading day here in the U.S. of the week. And, of course, Charlie breaking down equities. We're off our highs and lows of the session. Got a lot of economic news, a lot of earnings to get through. I feel like we're going to trade from day to day based on the tone in the news, Tim.
Yeah, I think so, too. And, I mean, I certainly see that playing out today with what's happening to Goldman Sachs shares as well. Let's get into it with Dana Doria, the co-CIO of the independent investment advisor, InvestNet. Dana joins us this afternoon via Zoom from Pennsylvania. Dana, good to have you back with us. How are you?
Great. Thanks for bringing me on.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. So what's your outlook for the year? I mean, I want to kind of move beyond today's trade and get an idea on what you're thinking for 2023.
Well, I think the consensus at this point has been first half of the year is going to be difficult still. We've got a lot that the markets still have to work through, not least of which, of course, is the coming debt ceiling fight, but also, you know, continued need for the Fed to sort of stay firm on rates, even if hiking can be reduced a little bit. The notion of a pivot is probably unlikely, at least until the second half of the year. But there is a growing chorus, I think, around the notion that, you know, second half of the year could pick up. And so, you know, kind of in our space, talking to advisors, talking to, you know, home offices, it really is about sort of having the discipline and hanging on and hope, looking forward to that comeback.
Hey, Dana, your firm, you guys offer investors ETFs, mutual funds, liquid alt portfolios. You also do fund strategist portfolios that combine a bunch of strategies and are managed by independent firms. Where are you moving money to? Where are you allocating more new money to right now and why? Give me an idea of where it's all going.
So I would say, you know, of course, we facilitate portfolios across any number of different types of strategies. And, you know, very strategic. For the most part, advisors look to keep their clients in portfolios that are allocated around their risk tolerance, right, their discipline. But what I'll say is, at a high level, in answer to your question, fixed income is where a lot of interest is being pointed right now. And of course, it's because we've experienced a lot of the pain of rising rates already last year. You know, much of what we expect is going to happen in fixed income has already been priced in at this point. And, you know, whereas fixed income took a real beating, you're now in a position where there's concern about recession. You know, that standard 60-40 that was really had a problem last year and you know, sort of a historically unprecedented, you know, double-digit losses on both sides of that 60, that 40, the equity fixed income. Now we're in a market that looks more, you know, traditional to what we would expect in terms of, okay, the fixed income position provides ballast to that portfolio. We're not expecting huge losses there anymore because rate increase is already there. And I think a lot of clients too, you know, in the run-up preceding all of this, you get overweighted in equities. And it's time to take a look at, you know, what that mix is and do you have enough fixed income in the portfolio?
What about when it comes to regions of the world where you're advising clients right now to put their money?
Yeah, I think valuations favor an international look. So, I mean, of course, you know, markets are cyclical. What's worked in the last 10 years doesn't necessarily tend to be the best place to be for the next 10 years. So when you're looking at these portfolios that have become very U.S. biased and, you know, the notion that, hey, how much international do we need? So many conversations over the last, you know, 5 years around, do I even need international stocks in the portfolio? You know, what's the real outlook there? I think we're increasingly seeing an interest now in exactly what you're saying, you know, and I would recommend, of course, a diversified view on international markets. You know, we can talk about specific regions, and China is always one that, you know, there's a large interest. If you have international developed and emerging markets, you probably have a big position in China. So I might say hedge your bets on that and, you know, have a little bit of a cap or a cap on the Chinese position. But U.S. to international, you really should be looking at having that overseas diversification in the portfolio.
That's interesting. Yeah, maybe, you know, I was talking about China earlier because I do feel like we continue to get these mixed signals about people saying, whoa, China reopening, what the opportunity for China going forward this year as well as globally. But then at the same time, you know, there are concerns that it's not going to be a straight move forward, if you will. You mentioned international. Emerging, though, if we, you know, kind of put China aside, emerging international, or do you like the developed play internationally?
I do think it's both.
Okay.
You know, so you're you know, emerging has the benefit of still being somewhat lower correlation to the U.S. than international developed. In fact, there's been some pretty good research around the fact that if you're doing an international focus and retail investors, right, they're probably investing in areas of that market that are large cap for the most part. You're getting a high correlation to U.S. stocks. Are you really getting the diversification benefits that you're looking for? Really, if you want to be, if you want to have a diversified exposure where you're actually hedging your bets on the U.S. side a little bit, you think about these large international companies, right? They're multinational. You know, the revenue that's coming, whether the U.S. or overseas, you know, in these large companies, it's very high correlation. But if you get into international smaller, mid to smaller stocks, international small value and emerging markets, you start to now get to areas of the market where you're seeing the correlations a little bit lower and you're getting some of that diversification benefit. We also, you know, there's an expectation that the dollar is not, you know, strengthening this year the way that it was last year.
Right.
And that, of course, helps your translated returns.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. Dana, thanks so much for weighing in. Dana DiOria, Co-Chief Investment Officer at Envestnet, joining us via Zoom from Pennsylvania on this Tuesday.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com.
The Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit returns to London on April 25th for a solutions-driven look at the sustainable business and finance landscape, looking at the latest trends in ESG regulations, supply chain innovation and transition finance. Speakers include leaders from CDP, Emirates Environment Group, Seedtrace, COA and more. Summit advisors include City Commercial Bank, Red Sea Global and Schneider Electric. Visit BloombergLive.com/SBS2024 to learn more.